Welcome to Wisdom of the Elders, featuring the stories and songs of elders from the Native Nations who lived and still live along the Lewis and Clark Trail. I'm Arlie Neskai of the Diné Nation. In the next hour, we'll feature the Nimiipuu, or Nez Perce tribe. We'll walk in the dapple light of a sacred cedar grove. We'll hear Nimiipuu songs once thought lost to history. We'll learn about the battle against diabetes and find out how a flute maker found his grandfather. And then we'll hear how Coyote fought his own battle against a monster destroying his world. But first, we'll meet elder and religious leader Horace Axtell.
So I brought him out, and he sat down in the front, and they start singing these translated hymns, and I could hear him singing.
This is Wisdom of the Elders. Stay with us. This is Jim Pepper performing Love Chant for a Lakota Lady from the album Remembrance on the Tutu label.
Thank you.
Jim Pepper performing Love Chant for Lakota Lady from the album Remembrance. Welcome to Wisdom of the Elders. I'm Arlie Nesky. Three boys played in the late September sun. The families were gathering camas roots and preparing foods for the winter in a nearby village. This was the homeland of the Nimiipuu, the real people. Today, they are known as the Nez Perce. Their territory once comprised most of the Snake River drainage in today's north-central Idaho and corners of Oregon and Washington. They fished, they gathered roots and berries, they hunted deer and elk in a maze of lush valleys and mountain terraces. On this afternoon, September 20th, 1805, the Nimiipuu numbered about 7,000. The three boys scattered when they saw the bearded white men riding toward them. Captain William Clark led an advanced team of the Corps of Discovery to search for food and contact the people he called the Chopinish, or Pierced Noses. Clark handed off his rifle and cornered two of the boys. It may be difficult for us today to imagine the boys' terror as Clark attempted to calm them, giving them little gifts. National Park Ranger Diane Malikin explains.
They had never seen anybody like this. Lewis found him, befriended him, gave him the pieces of ribbon. The boys went running back to the village to tell the big news.
Soon, the light-eyed strangers were invited to sit in the lodge of a headman. Villagers crowded into the teepee to have a look.
What they thought was, these might be some people visiting us from the past. They might not be people from the here and the now. And they might have a message for us. To me, the value in even that thought is because of how spiritually minded people were at one time. There really was no delineation between natural and supernatural. It was all one.
If there was a message, it was, your life is about to change. Within 30 years, Presbyterians had established a mission at Lapway, Idaho, and soon a schism had formed in the tribe between Christians and traditionalists. In 1855, the Nez Perce ceded about half of their homeland in exchange for a reservation of over 7 million acres. Another treaty in 1868 took away more land. Traditionalists grouped around the Joseph Band in the Wallowa Valley of northeast Oregon. Ordered to leave and move to the reservation, Joseph's followers held out for a decade. The government sent General O.O. Howard to Lapway. When a group of young Nez Perce men attacked some white settlers, Howard marched the army into the Wallowa. What followed was one of the most famous campaigns of the so-called Indian Wars. Joseph, with his brother Olokut and the war chief Looking Glass, fled with their band across 1,800 miles of mountainous territory towards Canada, fighting several bloody battles along the way. Finally, surrounded by superior forces, starving and believing all their people would be killed, Joseph surrendered just a few miles from the border, saying, "I will fight no more forever." Joseph and his followers were permanently banished from their homeland. Despite this tragedy, Chief Joseph's spiritual philosophy of peace and nonviolence has caused people from all over the world to remember and honor him to this day. I'm Arlie Nesky, and this is Wisdom of the Elders. Becoming a tribal elder is more than just getting old. There's a lifetime of lessons which call for much reflection and soul-searching. There's also commitment to preserving tradition and passing it on to younger generations to keep the heartbeat of a nation alive. Horst Axtell is a Nez Perce elder who's seen wars, racism, and his share of personal loss. But he's also experienced reconciliation, friendship, and forgiveness. In today's Elder Wisdom, Brian Bull shows how Axtell's gift to find the silver lining behind any cloud has helped his people thrive and celebrate their heritage.
Horace Axtell has spent his life cradled in the Valley, a rustic canyon area in northern Idaho, sliced deep by the Clearwater and Snake Rivers. Axtell's silver braided hair shimmers like sunlight on water, betraying his status as an elder. Axtell says it wasn't an easy path. There were connections to be made with his family and culture, and even a reconciliation. This meant seeking out someone who had hurt him deeply as a child.
I always remember my mother telling me, that man standing over there is your father. Why don't you go tell him hello? So I was just a kid, not very tall. But I went over there and he was talking to some of his friends, and he looked at me, never said a word. Then all of a sudden he turned back and kept on talking with his friends. And I stood there for a little bit, and finally I walked away. That did bother me a lot in my life. Growing up without a father is difficult.
Axtell never gave up on his father, but duty called after America entered World War II. Axtell joined the Army after learning his father had enlisted. The two never met overseas, but Axtell's mother died while he was away.
And when I came back in 1946, I had no mother to come back to, nobody waiting for me at the bus depot or anything. And our house was gone, and life was pretty rough there for a while. Finally, I found grandmother. I really loved my grandma. It was so good to be with her because the language just made me feel so important and strong again.
But his grandmother passed away, and Axtell went to work at the Potlatch Lumber Mill, a large employer for many locals. Through his coworkers, he learned that his father was living in the town of Kamiai and was doing a lot of heavy drinking.
So I found him, and he was drinking. And I told him, oh, I come up here, I heard you've been drinking a lot, and I come up here after work to look for you and offer you to come and live with me. I'll take care of you the rest of your life. I said, you're my father, and you'll always be my father, but I want you to understand one thing. I want to forgive you for not being my father when I was growing up. So this bothered him, even though he was drinking, and made him cry. And I guess finally he decided he'd come and live with me.
Although their relationship was often tested by drinking binges and sudden disappearances, Axtell says over time, he and his father began to connect more and more as the men shared their native tongue. This led to an unexpected turn in his father's life.
So one day, they was having an evangelistic meeting, I thought, here at Spalding Church right over here. And he asked me if I'd bring him out there for that. So I brought him out, and he sat down in the front, and they start singing these translated hymns, and I could hear him singing. And so I think, well, it's pretty close to the end of the service, so I went out and got in the car. It was in late November. I got in the car and to warm it up so my dad wouldn't be cold when he got in. He was getting up in age. Finally, he came out all by himself, and he come over and got in the car, and he told me in Nez Perce, he says, son, I became a Christian. My heart felt so good. I'm glad, I said. So we went on home, and we went to bed, and I went to work early the next morning, and I come back from work that night, and I looked in his room, and he was reading a Bible, and so I left him alone. So that's where his Christianity began.
Axtell began learning more of his family's history through his father and from many of the Nez Perce elders. Tribal stories, legends, and the language were shared in the sanctity of the Sweat Lodge, where Axtell got to know many of the tribe's most prominent members.
And some of the men folks were there that were veterans of the War of 1877. And I had the honor of sweating with them, and I listened to them tell stories and talk inside the sweat house. They always talked about this man called Tim Spussman. So one day when I was asking my father all these different questions about things about, then I told him this story about people talking about this man. And I looked over and he was quiet, and I looked at his eyes and he had tears in his eyes. And I said, "Well, what's the matter, Dad?" And he said, "That's my great-grandfather."
Axtell had reconnected with his father. Now he was connecting with an ancestor. He kept asking around about his great-grandfather's story and got an insight into his courage during the Nez Perce War of 1877.
And one incident during the war down at Big Hole Battlefield, when they got attacked down there that morning, my grandfather, he got behind a big tree, and he sat down and he began to sing his power song. And he sang there all the way through and hard and loud as he could. Start beginning to chase the soldiers down the hill. That's when I realized again that he was a powerful man.
Axtell's knowledge of both the traditional language and history of his people gave him a good reputation among the Nez Perce elders. He recalls seeing a car full of elders arrive at his home one night. Five women and two men got out and approached Axtell with a special request.
They said, "We come down to talk to you. We're really concerned about the old way of life, the old spirituality of our people, the old Nez Perce way that they themselves found out how to worship. And we have strong ways, and especially we're worried about the burial of our people. There's a lot of our people that don't belong to Christianity, but when they die, they have to be buried somehow, so they take them to the church and with a church funeral. We know that they were believers of their ancestors, the old ways. So they said, since you can speak the language real good, we're proud of you because we hear you talk. So what we want to learn from you is how you feel about this way. We don't want to know right now, but I want you to give you time to think about this." So I thought about it for a couple of weeks, and I ran into one of these old ladies, but she asked me, I made up my mind, and I told her right there, I said, "I'm willing to try. See, I don't know a thing about this old Nez Perce way of life, the spirituality that we have, but I'm willing to try to learn."
Axtell has learned so much that he's sought out by both tribal members and non-Indians to talk about history, language, and traditional Native values. But he reminds himself that it took perseverance and love to connect himself to his family and tribe, and he wants others to think positive as they attempt the same path themselves.
I always go back to the time I forgive my dad. You're not supposed to walk around with a negative feeling. Because if you do, whatever you're doing, you think you're doing the right thing, but this negativity is right with you and it is going to be there unless you let it go. Don't do that. So I try that. We have to try to go around these negative things and do what we're supposed to do. That's our way.
For Wisdom of the Elders, I'm Brian Bull.
Brian Bull is acting news director for Wisconsin Public Radio and is an enrolled member of the Nez Perce tribe. He lives with his wife, two kids, and three cats in Madison, Wisconsin. Coming up in Speaking Native, linguist Don Addison teaches us a little Nimiipuu. In Sacred Landscape, Judy Bluehorse Skelton shares her love of the timeless embrace of the Tree of Life. In Tribal Rhythms, Nico Wynn explores the newly restored music of Native collector Sam Morris. And in Health and Healing, Rose Hybear looks at how the Nimiipuu are working to defeat a killer in Indian country, type 2 diabetes.
Me being diabetic, and I thought, well, I'll get over this.
Now Mr. Casper, me come chat culture. Me tell you about the past, I come and tell you about the future. No dibby dibby DJ, I am on what betcha. Lyric that me teach you, that the one that I getcha. I tell you about the things the world not see. Honor them away, a government policy. They strip on me land at a Peabody. This a very serious, this is not unfunny. And we come, then we go, and then we go. Don't you know? And we come, then we go.
Welcome back. This is Wisdom of the Elders.
Halito, I'm Dawn Addison, and this is Speaking Native.
Hey, hey. Hey, ho, ho.
Nimiipu is a member of the Sahaptin language family located in Idaho and eastern parts of Washington and Oregon. The relationship between Nimiipu and its cousins like Yakima and Umatilla was noticed by Lewis and Clark, who recorded the languages in 1805. Butterflies abound in Lapway, Idaho, a town on the Nez Perce Reservation. The word Lapwe comes from non-native attempts to pronounce the Nimiipu word for butterfly, clap clap. Until next time, yakoke.
Dawn Addison is a Choctaw linguist and ethnomusicologist who teaches Native American languages and culture at the University of Oregon and other colleges in Oregon. Along the Nez Perce Trail in Idaho, an ancient grove of cedars still stands. Judy Bluehorse Skelton, who is Nez Perce and Cherokee, invites us on a walk where we'll come to know cedar intimately.
Cedar, the tree of life. Her green-laced branches curve earthward, enfolding all who step beneath her to touch her limbs and soft skin. She holds us close like a grandmother, in a timeless embrace that feels safe, serene, and loving. Her outer bark is hair-like. Long, reddish-brown shreds hang loosely, offering herself up willingly for basket-making, medicine, and so many other necessities of life. I remember the first time I was invited to go with the basket-makers to gather cedar bark. While I do not consider myself a basket-maker, my love of plants and medicine-making put me there that cold, misty morning in March. As we walked through the forest, we noted those cedars that had been sprayed with blue paint. They were targeted for logging. It was for this reason that we had permission to gather their bark. The forest was lush and very quiet, as cedar groves often are, but this silence was heavy with the somber realization that some in their community had been tagged, marked for death. They would no longer dwell on this mountain with all their relatives. With respect, we spread out and disappeared into the forest to find our tree. I offered tobacco and I offered a song to honor this great cedar and the life it would be giving. As I circled the tree, running my fingers around its body, my tears became one with the light rain that had started falling. There are stories that tell of a time when the plants, animals, and humans could all communicate with one another. It's perhaps this kind of communication, a communion, that sometimes takes place when we are with the plant world. Such was the case as I finished my song and touched the tree. The communion with the cedar was clear, strong, and unmistakable. Share my story with the children. Share my bark, my skin, with the children. Cedar will be remembered and live on through them. I gathered the cedar that day and have shared her 20-foot ribbons of bark with thousands of children since then. The many gifts of cedar contribute to her status as the tree of life. Her aromatic leaves and heartwood contain antiviral and antifungal medicines. Her beautiful smooth-grained wood and mold resistance made her an ideal choice for making homes, canoes, feast bowls, baskets, and food storage boxes. Native people of the Northwest Coast wove the soft, pliable inner bark into rain hats and capes, dresses and skirts. Cedar's sacred gifts of cleansing and purification in the spiritual realm as well as the physical realm are acknowledged and practiced today as part of ceremonial life. A sacred grove of cedars, over 1,000 years old, still stands along the Lhoksa River in the Lolo Pass of Idaho. Situated near the Nimiipuu Trail, also known as the Nez Perce Trail, it is part of the Lewis and Clark Trail today. My father remembers camping along the river near the cedars with his parents and sisters in the 1930s. Named the Devoto Cedar Grove, you can visit these remaining ancient trees by traveling along Idaho's Highway 12 through the Lolo Pass. Biologists and historians are alarmed at the extensive clear-cutting of old-growth forests adjacent to the Devoto Grove site and have asked the state of Idaho to purchase these lands from the private logging companies so they may be preserved for future generations. The old story reminds us that it was humans' greed and disrespectful behavior that cost them their ability to communicate with the plant and animal worlds. While we may shop at the mall for today's necessities, cedar is still revered as the tree of life because it sustained our ancestors and for its sacred teachings, as valuable now as they were 1,000 years ago. Flexible but enduring, gentle but strong, living in a circle, a grove, a community, supporting the young ones coming up and creating sacred space wherever they are. In creating sacred space, they offer us the gifts of longevity, perseverance, and forgiveness. With each breath, with each step, with each heartbeat, Osadadu.
Educator, writer, and herbalist Judy Bluehorse Skelton is Nez Perce, Chickasaw, and Cherokee. She teaches, gardens, and serves in the vibrant community of Portland, Oregon. You're listening to a unique recording made on wax cylinder sometime between 1909 and 1912. The cylinder was made not by an East Coast collector or anthropologist, but by a Nez Perce Indian named Sam Morris, or Horse Blanket, a far-thinking man who in photographs seems equally as comfortable in his buckskins as in a suit and tie. Sam Morris recorded more than 60 cylinders. Unavailable to the public for generations, they were brought to the attention of ethnomusicologist Lauren Olson. Compiler of Washington State University's Nez Perce Music Archive, Dr. Olson had the Sam Morris collection digitally cleaned up and repackaged for the tribe and for the world. Nico Wind has more.
105 years after the Lewis and Clark expedition first entered Nez Perce country, Sam Morris set up his Edison recording device and asked his friends to sing into the large funnel. Because of this, we are privileged to hear music that is no longer performed anywhere in quite the same way. This song is called a smoke song or a pipe song. It was sung as the pipe man opened his sacred bundle and prepared a ceremonial pipe. The voices you hear introduce a meeting song of a social gathering. They say, "My people, this is how you have fun." This song is called Timini Panisha, I Give My Heart, sometimes called a Drop the Handkerchief song. One similar in style was said to have been sung in Chief Joseph's lodge when reminiscing about old times. Mr. Morris seems to have been interested in recording songs that were already old in his day and in danger of disappearing. In many of the introductions, they speak of the old way or the old songs. We are listening to music that may have emerged many generations before it was recorded. It says something about the endurance of native culture that some of the dances and aspects of these songs have survived into the 21st century. In this war dance song, or buffalo dance, the men move toe-heel, heel-toe, toe-heel. Today, this dance is called a crow hop. It's popular in powwows across North America. This honor song is also called a memorial song. Before the song begins, the speaker says, "My friends, many times we have sung here at this house where we heard songs for enjoyment. We are some of the last survivors from this land, my friends. That is why you should honor yourselves during the time of enjoyment." Sometimes people pigeonhole Indians, thinking they should be doing just Indian music. In this square dance, Sam Morris lets us know that his people enjoyed a dance that you might call a frontier import. In this selection, the speaker tells a war story. In it, he wrestles an enemy to the ground. His friends cheer him on. His friends are happy to celebrate his victory over an enemy. Every so often, another speaker sitting around the drum tells a rousing story and leads an inspiring song. That was the traditional way of the old people. Dr. Lauren Olson writes in his liner notes, "These songs and their intermittent shouts and pulsating rhythms help today's Nez Perce descendants relive the times of a dynamic past as they extend their hopes well into the uncertain future." As we listen beneath the scratchy surface, we can hear the soul of a people, wounded, threatened, but still strong and full of pride and the love of beauty. For Wisdom of the Elders, this is Nico Wind.
Tribal Rhythms is written by ethnomusicologist Don Addison, produced by Clark Salisbury and Larry Johnson, and hosted by Nico Wint. Thanks to the Nez Perce Music Archive, to Washington State University Pullman, and to Alan Pinkham for his translations. Since Columbus, epidemic disease has devastated Native American communities. Today, many of those diseases have disappeared. One, however, is just now approaching epidemic proportions. It is type 2 diabetes. But with proper care, increased exercise, and changes in diet, diabetes can be controlled. In today's Health and Healing, Rose Highbear explores some of the ways the Nez Perce people are fighting back.
Since the 1940s, the rate of diabetes among Native people has steadily grown and is still growing.
We don't eat anything like we used to eat. We used to eat a lot of roots that were high in nutrition and fiber. We worked hard, and so what food we did eat, we used it.
Valerie Albert works at the Nimiipuu Health Clinic in Lapway, Idaho. An enthusiastic warrior in the battle against diabetes, Valerie takes each case as a personal challenge.
And I get really excited about it. For every moment that they're exercising and taking care of themselves, they are possibly preventing damage to their system.
Valerie introduces a cheerful woman of 64 named Karen Zachary, who's been struggling with diabetes for over 20 years.
And I got an asthma attack and pneumonia on top of that, and I had almost passed away. And that's when they started me on insulin. My diabetes was full-blown then, just from being ill.
Diabetes is an inability of the body to produce or respond to insulin, a hormone that allows blood sugars to enter the cells and be used for energy. With the diagnosis of diabetes, Karen's life came packaged in the clear liquid of a syringe.
Me being diabetic, and I thought, well, I'll get over this. It was scary, too.
In the healthcare community, there has been a slow realization that education is essential in the war against diabetes. Health worker Valerie Albert.
It's hard to see somebody that you give the knowledge to, but they're not ready to accept they even have a problem. We talk about, well, I'm borderline. I don't really believe that there's anything such as a borderline diabetic. You are or you aren't. You know, it's like I'm either kind of pregnant or not pregnant, or, you know.
As part of their education program, the NIMIPU Health Clinic has started a talking circle so that diabetics can voice their concerns and share information.
We just go in and talk and share stories, or if we have a problem, we bring that out and kind of release our tension. And it helps me because I see somebody that's maybe in worse shape or has more problems than I do. And each time I go to a meeting, I learn something.
Along with education, medical care, and a healthy diet, the most important part of treating diabetes is exercise.
So I thought, oh, I don't feel like it today. And then that's when I figured that's when I should be out there exercising. But it's amazing how what few minutes exercise we do helps our sugar.
Valerie is producing an exercise video for diabetics who are confined to a wheelchair.
There's actually a warm-up before they do stretches so they can prevent injury. We'll do some reaching, upper arm stretches, behind the back stretches, and then eventually we'll start using a towel to stretch their legs, because everybody has a towel in their house, so they don't have to have any special equipment. So we'll be doing some movements put to some drum music just to get them going a little bit.
Get the word out. Ask questions.
For Wisdom of the Elders, this is Rose Hybear.
Health and Healing is written and produced by Larry Johnson in collaboration with KCUW-LP-FM Radio at the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indians. It's funded by the Benton Foundation Sound Partners for Community Health and by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is dedicated to improving health and health care for all Americans. For more information about our guests or to help support our program through Friends of Wisdom of the Elders, check out our website at wisdomoftheelders.org. Coming up on Artist Circle, Bruce Crespin brings us a story of the surprising connection between a turn-of-the-century photograph, an old wax cylinder recording, and a modern-day flute maker. Then on Turtle Island Storytellers, Alan Pinkham teaches us what to do if you ever find yourself swallowed by a monster.
They said, oh, the monster is devouring all our people. You got to do something about this.
Stay with us. I'm Arlie Nesky, and this is Wisdom of the Elders.
Wisdom of the Elders is an American Indian nonprofit organization with a mission of cultural preservation, education, and race reconciliation. We record and share the oral history and cultural arts of Indigenous elders, storytellers, historians, and song carriers.
The flute makes the music of life for many indigenous peoples and tribal cultures. Traditionally, among the Nimiipuu, flutes carried songs and much more. The flute was instrumental in native courtship. A married man's flute was decorated to display his marital status, while available men held unadorned flutes for all to see. Today in Artist Circle, Bruce Crespin tells a story of how Nimiipuu flutist, artist, and museum specialist Kevin Peters discovered the flute of his ancestors.
Nez Perce Kevin Peters lives and works as a curator and park interpreter in Spalding, Idaho, at the Nez Perce National Historic Park. Kevin is an artist, too, who has made paintings and also created precise replicas of 19th century Nimiipuu rawhide containers. Kevin and his collaborators are also devoted to reviving the traditional tribal arts of flute playing and flute making.
And around the turn of the century, about 100 years ago, a lot of men had flutes. And so we decided to create flutes again and play them. We had flute recordings. We knew of a person who had made flutes. We knew of people who had flutes. We decided it needs to be picked up again before it goes away.
Kevin made contacts with elders and others, seeking knowledge about making and playing Indian flutes, and acquired many recordings of flute music. With much effort, he learned how to use native materials to fashion flutes.
Anything that's tubular in that shape and about that size, they can make flutes out of. We found out gun barrels, smoothbore gun barrels, have been made into flutes. The original elderberry, metip, made into flutes when the original materials used for it.
Kevin's personal life, tribal culture, and museum career all collided when his father made a startling revelation. John Minthorn, or Swan Necklace, was a man in a turn-of-the-century photograph about whom Kevin had been giving lectures.
Well, about 8 years ago, my paternal father came in and sat next to this photograph. While I'm ending my program and talking about this gentleman who had been a Nez Perce warrior and the fact that he played flute, I ended my program and my dad said, "Well, do you know who that guy is?" And I said, "Well, yeah, that's Witiyetmiswahayak, Swan Necklace." And then my dad dropped the bomb and he'd say, "Well, did you know that that is your great-grandfather?" So all of a sudden I have a connection with this Nez Perce warrior here who has a flute, who has a flute.
Flutes and flute music were used in quite personal ways. Kevin could imagine Swan Necklace courting his grandmother with its sound.
He could court at a distance. She could literally sit between her parents inside of her lodge while he played from a distance. And if she knew the song and he knew the song, only they would be in on the idea of the courting. Until probably his uncle comes over and says, "You know, they seem to be a good match. Let's have a wedding trade." And they'd have a big trade and you would have a wedding.
Kevin's awareness and enthusiasm about his ancestor, the flute-playing Nez Perce warrior named John Minthorn, took on new dimensions with a surprise turn of events.
I was standing at the front desk out here in uniform, being an interpretive ranger. A gentleman walks in and walks up to me and says, "How would you like to have John Minthorn's flute back?" I about fell over. Literally, I about fell over. And I said, "The one in the photo." And he said, "Yes, the one in the photo. I know what photo you're talking about." I was stunned, literally stunned, shocked. Now, interestingly enough, when it came in, I looked at the flute, and it had a otter fur wrap on it. And the back of the wrap was painted yellow on the original flute. And I knew one thing. Only our women in the Northwest painted their hair wraps yellow on the back of their hair wraps. Literally what this does is it's an item to be seen in public. You would take it out at dances and it would say, "I'm married. I'm taken." So not only did I get my elder's flute back, we got my female elder's hair wrap back on the same thing. So what you see on the wall here over here, now this is a copy of it. Okay. I can show you the original. It's downstairs here now. You can see the swan's head on it, brass tacks for eyes. Tell you what, just for a moment, I'll play my elder's flute that we have right here and give you a little sound on that so we can actually hear a little bit what this sounds like. You know, is this the sound he made? Is this a sound that my elder female heard?
For Wisdom of the Elders, I'm Bruce Crespin.
Bruce Crespin is a California Mission Indian and traditional basket weaver who works as a cultural heritage specialist for the U.S. Department of the Interior in Portland, Oregon.
There along the Clearwater River, down on the middle section of the Snake River, and then over on the Salmon River, and then also the Grand Round River, there's a lot of landmarks. Where they're either stones or land features or rock formations, they have stories attached to them.
Our storyteller, Alan Pinkham, takes us on a journey with Coyote, sharing with us the creation story of his people on the Clearwater River.
Coyote was traveling with his brother, Fox. They were coming up the river, and then they met some people, animal people. They said, "Oh, the monster is devouring all our people. You got to do something about this. You should do something about this monster. He's breathing in and devouring all our people." So Coyote, he prepares himself, and he, you know, makes a rope, and he makes a little bag with pitch and a firestone. And so he prepares himself, and he goes up on a Camas Prairie, and he goes over to where Grangeville, Idaho is now, and he hollers and he teases a monster. He says, "Oh, you can't devour me like you did the other people." He says, "I'm over here," and he makes a bunch of noise, and the monster wondering, "Well, what is that? You know, who's calling me?" So the monster, he raises his head up above the ridgeline there from the Clearwater River near Kamei, Idaho. And he looks over towards Coyote, and there's Coyote. He says, "You can't devour me like you did these other people." Says, and then Coyote, he ties himself to the mountains behind him. And the monster says, "I can suck you in just like I did the other animal people." And says, "Well, you go ahead." And so the monster, he draws in his breath, and Coyote comes, and he's going into the mouth, but the rope stops him. Before he goes in the monster mouth. "See, I told you," he says, "you can't devour me like you did the other people." So the monster, he tries that three times. On the third time, Coyote reaches behind him, and with the flint knife that he made, he cuts the rope and he goes in the mouth of the monster. And inside, he sees animal people that have been sucked in, and some of them are dead and some are just bones, you know, laying around. Others are struggling to stay alive. And so he walks around and he tells the people, says, "I come here to save you." But Grizzly Bear, he growls at Coyote. And Coyote says, "Well, what are you growling at me for?" Says, "I come here and here to save you, and here you're growling at me." And so Grizzly Bear growls again, and so Coyote pushes his nose, and that's why Grizzly Bear has a flat nose now. And Coyote walks around some more, and Rattlesnake strikes at him. He says, "What are you striking at me for?" He says, "Oh, I'm here to save you. You shouldn't be rattling and striking at me." So Coyote steps on his head and flattens Rattlesnake's head. So that's why Rattlesnake, he has a flat head now. And then Coyote goes around and he sees the people. He says, "One, I'm going to free you people." He says, "When this, and I'm going to kill the monster." And says, "You all go to the holes of this monster and you wait there. And when the monster takes the last breath, then you run out of the holes and you'll be free." And so he tells the people that, and so he builds a little fire, you know, from some of the things inside the monster, and so he can see. And He reaches up with his, he has five flint knives, and he starts cutting the heart loose. And he cuts and he cuts, he breaks a flint knife, and he gets another one. He cuts and he cuts and he breaks another knife. And he's down to the last knife, and the heart is just barely hanging on with one strip of flesh yet. So Coyote says, "This monster is about ready to die. All you people get prepared to run out." And so he cuts a last bit of flesh, and then the heart falls, and all animal people get ready, and the monster takes this last breath. He breathes, and all the holes open up in the monster's body, you know, like the nose, the mouth, and even that little hole underneath the tail. It all opens up. And so when the holes open up, then all the animal people run out. And the last one out is Muskrat. And the hole underneath the tail closes on Muskrat's tail and strips all the hair off of him. So that's why Muskrat doesn't have any hair on his tail, because he was the last one out and barely made it. And Coyote comes out. He's also out too. And they all gather outside, and then Fox says, "Well, what are you going to do with this monster's body now? You got to do something with it." And Coyote, he thinks a while. He says, "Well, this place needs human beings. You know, this world, it needs human beings." And so Fox says, "Well, what are you going to do?" And he says, "Well, I'll cut up this monster. And I'll throw body parts of the monster in all the directions, and I'll create tribes and all on this island." And so Coyote starts cutting up the legs and the arms and other parts, and he starts throwing them in all the directions. And as those parts hit the ground, tribes spring up. You know, tribes all over the Northwest and what is now called the United States. So all the tribes like the Blackfeet, the Cheyenne, the Shoban, Paiute, Yakimas, and Okanagans, they all become tribal people and human beings. And then he's almost done, and then Fox says, "Well, what are you going to do about people in this valley? It's one of the most beautiful valleys and a place to live, and it's a good place to be." And Coyote thinks a while, and he says, "Oh, and all he has is just blood. And I think there's a liver and a heart left." And he says, "Well, I better create people right here." And so Fox brings him some water, and he washes his hands, and he raises his hands, and he throws the blood and the water down on the ground. And as drops of blood and water hit the earth, then the Nipu people spring up, Nez Perce people, and that's who we are. And then these people will occupy this valley and all the river valleys in this area. It's a good place to be, and these people will have good hearts, and they'll be strong people. And so that's how we were created. And then Fox says, "Well, how do you know that this story or this creation happened?" Coyote says, "Well, I have the heart and liver here. I'll leave these here." So he takes the heart and he sets it upright, and it's a big stone there. And it looks like a heart standing, you know, with a point up in the air. Then over to the about 100 yards away, there's a flat strip of land that looks like a liver. And those are the two land features where this creation happened. And so that's how we became human beings, Ninipu people. And there's no story that we ever came from some other area, that we migrated or created and came here. We were created right on the Clearwater River. And from there, we spread all over the country. So that's how we got created.
Nez Perce historian and storyteller Alan Pinkham, great-great-grandnephew of Chief Joseph, has generously shared the history and stories of the Nez Perce with the world. On today's program, we have learned more about the Nimiipuu people. We have heard from their spiritual leaders, their historians, and storytellers. Learned more about their musical traditions and their artists. We have found that despite two centuries filled with flight and exile, loss of land and language, and institutionalized religion and education, the Nimiipuu have not merely survived into the 20th century, they have evolved into national leaders of reconciliation. Not only have they become known as a nation that fed and provided assistance to the men of the Lewis and Clark expedition, they also stepped forward during the early planning of the Lewis and Clark bicentennial to make statements of reconciliation to Indian and non-Indian groups planning the signature events. They even conducted a healing ceremony for everyone in attendance. Knowing that the greatness of their heritage was a key to recovery, they encouraged other nations and the circle of tribal advisors not to turn the bicentennial into a protest. Instead, they could use this commemoration to heal the past and send the American people positive messages about their traditions, their accomplishments, and their hopes for the future. We are proud to witness the honor and respect our tribal leaders have shown through the trail commemoration. We honor the Nimiipuu for their role in remembering their ancestors' teaching, that it is much easier to forgive. We thank you for joining us today on Wisdom of the Elders Radio. I'm Arlie Neskai. Hogoanet. Till we meet again.
Wisdom of the Elders Radio is produced in Portland, Oregon, with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail at National Park Service, the Benton Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Oregon Arts Commission. Special thanks to our team, producers Clark Salisbury, Brian Bull, Judy Bluehorse Skelton, Don Addison, Bruce Crespin, and Carl Shanks. Story editor and director, Larry Johnson. Program host, Arlie Neskahai. Tribal Rhythms host, Nico Wind. Web team, Clark Salisbury and Sean Dillon. Archivist, Paul Woodsong. Tribal liaison, Elaine Lanigan. Transcriber, Anna Kastner. Distribution manager, Beth Dillon. Executive producer, Rose Highberry. Special thanks to our friends at Jack Straw Productions, Seattle, Washington. To Deborah Crosswell at the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, to our educational scholars Larry McClure, Ray DeMolly, Sally Thompson, Jim Ronda, and Lauren Olson, and to American Indian Radio on satellite. Thanks to Paul Eubanks at Ten Wolves Productions and to Nico Wynn for providing our theme sounds. And special thanks to all the recording artists and music producers who generously shared their music for our program.
We will walk.
We will walk.